Open your Bibles with me tonight, please, to the book of Isaiah, chapter 59. One of the most powerful and moving verses in all of the Word of God to me. Isaiah, chapter 59. In a few moments, we'll read verse 19. A great contemporary preacher by the name of Brother John Jenkins told the following story. He said, the man was a very successful pastor. God was blessing his ministry in a mighty way. By his own testimony, he said right at that time, it seemed like their ministry was getting ready to explode with the blessing of God. He said, my wife and I at that moment entered into the darkest 2.5 year period of our entire lives. God had blessed them with 3 precious children. Their oldest daughter was a beautiful blonde-haired young lady. When she got around 16, she seemed to get a little distant. And they thought it was just teenage symptoms as they worked trying to get the church off the ground, so busy in the ministry. He said they didn't notice until it was too late that she was seriously withdrawing from the family and the things of God. 2 days before her 16th birthday, the worst of all nightmares took place. She ran away from home and disappeared into the streets of one of America's most ungodly cities. They learned that a man several years older had stolen her affection from her mom and dad and convinced her that he loved her. She disappeared with him into a life of sin. The preacher said he begged and pleaded with her, scolded her and argued with her, but the harder he tried to get her to come home and get right, things just got worse. Several months into the nightmare, it seemed like their lives would come to an end. They lived on the other side of town from the church, about a 25-minute drive, and every Sunday morning, he'd leave early and the family would come a little later. All the way across town, he drove as he wept and cried, God, hundreds and hundreds of people are going to be in church today. They've got burdens and needs. They need me encouraged, but God, what about me? I'm dying inside. God, I need your help. I got to give everybody else something today, but God, who's got anything for me? His heart was breaking in two. As if this were not bad enough news, his wife began to have major physical problems, and the doctor informed them that she had the early stages of cancer and needed an immediate major surgery. And he encouraged them to not put it off. He said, if we don't get it now, she may have to face chemotherapy as well. As they prayed over the decision, the doctor said, I need to warn you about something. When ladies go through this type of a surgery, sometimes when they come out of it, they emotionally go through some really dark hours. Some things change chemically in their bodies, and though some women do okay, there are others who go through dark depression. But I don't even think you can consider that because your wife's whole life is in the balance if she does not have the surgery. They decided to go forward. She had the surgery and it was successful, but just a few days out of surgery, it seemed the devil took opportunity and went after the pastor's wife. She was overwhelmed with depression. One night she dreamed she could see Satan and he said, hey, preacher's wife, go ahead and build a big church and reach a city for God, but while you're doing that, I'm going to get your children. I already have one and I'm going to get the other two. She told her husband about her nightmare. Like any mother who loves her children, her heart was overwhelmed. She got scared and told her husband, we need to leave the church. We need to resign and get out of this wicked city. This city has already devoured one of our children. We've got to get out of here now. She lost the ability to even think clearly. Her husband tried to plead with her that the safest place in the world for the Christian is the will of God, but she was overwhelmed by depression. She told her husband finally, that's fine, you can stay, but I'm not staying. The preacher the next Sunday pulled out of the driveway on his way to church, wondering when he got home if his wife and children would even be there. A little over 6 weeks, he went to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night, and his wife was so deep in depression, would not leave the house, scared for her children and so on. He said, my world had come to an end. I had a big church, a successful ministry, but for all intents and purposes, I was a miserable failure. They were under a tremendous satanic assault. His wife was an accomplished songwriter, and one day in the middle of all the darkness, she went to the piano and began to play some familiar songs. She said it was almost like the Spirit of God came into the room. One dreary afternoon, with a pen in one hand, as she plunked out the notes, she wrote these words on the piano. In my moments of fear, through every pain, every tear, there's a God who's been faithful to me. When my strength was all gone, when my heart had no song, I'm still in His love. He's truly faithful to me. Every word He's promised is true, and what I thought was impossible, I see my God do. He's been faithful, faithful to me. And God used the song to bring her out of the depression. She got back on her feet and got back in with her husband. He said, although that was good news on the front with our daughter, things were just getting worse by the day. Almost 2 years had gone by. She was 18 and living a wicked life. He said, every time I got up in the pulpit to preach, every time a sinner walked down the aisle, I would look for the face of my daughter. He was in Florida preaching a conference and got a phone call from a preacher friend who had been a friend of the family for years and said, preacher, I've got some heavy news I've got to share with you. Your daughter came by my office today and we had a long talk. What'd she say? Preacher, she said, she's 18 now, an adult. You and your wife are just going to have to live with her decisions. She isn't coming home and she isn't going to get right. She just wants you to accept her like she is. He hung the phone up. The next couple of minutes seemed like the most empty minutes he'd ever lived. He didn't know what to say or to think. He said he began to fall apart and literally fell off the bed onto the floor and rolled up into a fetal position and began to weep and moan. He said, oh, God, no. We dedicated her in an altar. We gave that girl to you. No, God, I'm not going to accept the way she is. God, if it kills me, I'm going to pray until my daughter gets right with God. Isaiah chapter 59, verse 19. So shall they fear the name of the Lord from the west, and His glory from the rising of the sun. When the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord shall lift up a standard against him. I want to speak to you tonight on the subject, the flag of the Christian life, or are you flying your flag? I was reading an article in the January 2006 issue of Israel My Glory magazine. The article is entitled, What a Difference a Flag Makes. On December the 21st, 2001, it says, the late Palestinian Authority Chairman Yasser Arafat made this statement. One of our cubs or one of our flowers, referring to a Palestinian boy or girl, will wave the flag of Palestine, Allah willing, over the walls of Jerusalem, its churches, and its mosque, whether someone likes it or not, and whoever does not like it can drink the water of the Dead Sea. Arafat's flag-placing pronouncement, he says, has been repeated consistently by both his cohorts in the Palestinian Authority and his other terrorist allies. And it must not be taken lightly. It is a serious declaration of intent with equally serious implications. Then there is a big picture right in the middle of the magazine here of a synagogue in the Gaza Strip. And the Palestinians, after the Gaza Strip, after the Israelis had to leave the Gaza Strip, the Palestinians are inside the synagogue. They have torched the synagogue, and whatever can be burned is burning. Much of it is steel and concrete and would not burn. And it says that jubilant Palestinians planted flags atop the rubble of former Israeli settlements and set the Jewish houses of worship ablaze after the Israelis evacuated their homes where they had lived for 38 years. Now, that article spoke to me about the importance of a flag. He says, we're going to put that flag, Yasser Arafat said, we're going to fly the Palestinian flag over the walls of Jerusalem, its churches, its mosques, and if people don't like it, they can drink water out of the Dead Sea. And as soon as they took over the Gaza Strip, they bring their flag, they plant their flag, and they lift it high where the Israeli flag once stood. I wondered right away, when I read that article, what the Bible said about flags. We've got a United States flag here. We have a Christian flag here. And so I looked up the word flag. And I found out that the word as we use it doesn't even occur in the Bible. The Bible uses three other words to refer to a flag. It uses the word standard. That word occurs 22 times, 13 of those in the book of Numbers. It uses the word ensign, E-N-S-I-G-N, which occurs 9 times. And it uses the word banner, which occurs 6 times, standard, ensign, and banner, a total of 37 times in the Bible. Those three words refer to flags. And there are actually a couple of more besides those that I'll show you later. So what is the importance of a flag anyway? A flag is for identification. It is for identification. In the book of Numbers, the children of Israel were traveling from Egypt to the Promised Land. They had tents that were erected all around the tabernacle. There were 1 million people camped out there in that wilderness. And these people were in tents in a massive encampment all around the holy tabernacle. How would they know who was where? They would look for the flags. Numbers chapter 2, verse 3. And on the east side, toward the rising of the sun, shall they of the standard or the flag of the camp of Judah pitched throughout their armies. Chapter 2, verse 10. On the south side shall be the standard or the flag of the camp of Reuben. Numbers 2, 18. On the west side shall be the standard of the camp of Ephraim. Chapter 2, verse 25. The standard of the camp of Dan shall be on the north side. So, there was Judah's flag on the east side. There was Reuben's flag on the south side. There was Ephraim's flag on the west side. And there was Dan's flag on the north side. Until I studied this, I thought there was a flag for each of the 12 tribes of Israel, but I could not find that. Apparently, there was one flag for each three tribes. What did these flags have on them anyway? We don't really know for sure. Let me speculate if you don't mind, because it might help you picture this in your mind. My guess is that the flag, the first flag that's mentioned for the flag or the standard of the camp of Judah, my guess is it had a symbol of a lion on it. The lion of the tribe of Judah. I was talking to my father-in-law last night, and he told me that he had read years ago in an old book that probably went back into the 1800s, where a fellow said he thought those four flags had on them the same pictures as the four creatures in Ezekiel chapter 1 verse 10 in relation to the cherubim, the lion, the ox, the eagle, and a symbol of a man. I don't know whether that's so or not. But it could have been that the flag of Judah had on it a picture of a lion. It could have been that the flag of Reuben had on it a picture of an ox. It could have been that the tribe of Ephraim, that their flag had on it the picture of an eagle. It could have been that the standard or the flag of the tribe of Dan had the picture of a man on it. We don't really know. These flags not only gave identification. You could look in any direction of the camp and you knew what tribe was over there. You knew what direction. If a child got lost, he just looked for the flag. He moved toward the flag. The flags also led the people. Can you picture a little boy walking along with his daddy as the whole camp is moving through the wilderness? And he looks at his daddy and he says, "Daddy, how do we know what direction to go?" And his daddy says, "Son, look up there. You see that flag? That flag is our standard, and we simply follow that flag." In chapter 10, verse 14 of Numbers, it says, "In the first place went the standard or the flag of the camp of the children of Judah." And then verse 18 says, "And the standard of the camp of Reuben set forward according to their armies." And so you had Judah move first, then Reuben's flag came next, then Ephraim's flag came next, and then Dan's flag came next. God said, "This is the order in which they move." And they moved with, look at this, I love this picture. You've seen these battle scenes where a man is holding the American flag and he is charging forward with that American flag. And that is exactly a picture of the way the children of Israel moved forward through the wilderness. There was a man at the front of Judah and he was leading with the flag and everybody followed that flag. And then Reuben's flag and then Ephraim's flag and then Dan's flag. And so it gave them an identity. Have you ever thought about the struggle that America had coming up with Old Glory, the red, white, and blue, and how they came to that? Did you know there was a time when there were actually a number of different flags for identification? Writing in the History Channel magazine, somebody wrote, "What did the American flag look like during the American Revolution?" And the answer was this. Flag design was a growth industry in the American colonies as the storms of revolt gathered in the 1770s. Some of the early banners featured rattlesnakes. Can you imagine America having a flag with a rattlesnake on it? Why? It was a symbol of deadly force, vigilance, and wisdom. Another flag had on it pine trees. Why? Hardiness and steadfastness. Several authorities believe that a Bunker Hill flag bearing a pine tree was carried by colonial troops at the famous battle in Boston on June the 17th, 1775. In early 1776, General George Washington's new Continental Army used the Grand Union flag, which displayed 13 longitudinal red and white straps, and in the corner, a British Union Jack. This banner nicely expressed several themes: loyalty to the king, anger at Parliament, and ambivalence about breaking free. History also records that General George Washington and two other members of the Continental Congress came to the home of Betsy Ross in May of 1776 and asked her to sew the first flag. It is said that they wanted the stars to have 6 points on it, and that Betsy Ross showed them how she could fold something, cut it once, and get 5 points, and they said, "Fine, put 5 points on it." Whether that's so or not, I don't know, but I read that just this afternoon in an article. Now, so what is the importance of a flag? It is for identification. I love this. Can I tell you something? Even if you didn't know you were in America, virtually anywhere you went in America, you would know you were in America if you knew what our flag looks like. It flies over the U.S. Capitol. It flies over every state capitol. It flies over our courthouses. It flies over our city halls. It flies on our streets. It flies in front of our businesses. It flies in front of our airports. It flies in front of our homes. It flies in front of our churches. In fact, there's a huge one on the wall of our gym now in the new ministry center. We got one flying over there. Knowing that I was working on this message, I just started watching, as I was out visiting and soul winning yesterday, I started watching to see how many flags I might see in our little town. You know, I was shocked how many flags we got in our little town. There are flags everywhere. We're so used to seeing them, we don't see them. They're on the street corners. There's one on the city office uptown. They're just all over town. Identification. Wherever you go in the world and you see the red, white, and blue flag that we call Old Glory, you automatically think about America, don't you? If you've ever been to another country and seen their flag flying, and then you go, and I've done this once or twice, to an American embassy, there's something about seeing the Star Spangled Banner flying over an embassy in another country. There's a feeling to that. It's almost indescribable. You're going down this street. I remember being in Guyana, South America, and it's sort of third world there, and we're going down the street, and Brother Hassan Abraham said to us, you know, while one of the first things we need to do is we need to go to the American Embassy, let them know that you're here, take photocopy of your passport and do that. He said, that's what I always recommend. It's just a good thing to do. So we went there, and we're in sort of this third world country area, and you look up in the distance and you see a flag flying about two blocks away. And a beautiful building, and you just keep your eyes on that flag, and you come up to this gate, and it's like, wow, Americans, what a blessing. Christian, there is a flag. There is a standard that is supposed to be flying over your life. That flag identifies you as being who you are. Do you know what that flag is? Are you gladly flying that flag? I'm talking about the importance of the flag. First of all, for identification, it tells who you are. Secondly, I like this, the flag is important as a rallying point. In fact, it is really an emotional rallying point. Did you get the impact of Isaiah 59:19, so shall they fear the name of the Lord from the west and his glory from the rising of the sun. When the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord shall lift up a standard, a flag against him. Here's the enemy coming in, and the Spirit of the Lord lifts up a standard, an emotional rallying point. Isaiah 49:22, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will lift up mine hand to the Gentiles and set up a standard, a flag to the people, the Gentiles, and they shall bring their sons in their arms, and thy daughters shall be carried upon their shoulders. It's a picture. It's an emotional rallying point. Isaiah 62:10. Go through the gates. Prepare you the way of the people. Cast up the highway. Gather out the stones. Lift up a standard for the people. Last July, I believe it was, I was in Phoenix, Arizona, speaking at a convention there. And I spoke one night for a graduation, and they were using a large auditorium in the convention center. There were probably 1,500 to 2,000 people there that night. And I was looking at the program, and it was telling what was going to take place in that program. And just early in the program, it said the presentation of the colors. And I was wondering what they were going to do. And they did something I've never seen before. I loved it. It was incredible. There was the man who was the spokesman for the evening stood up and said, we'll all stand for the presentation of the colors. And the whole crowd stood, and then in the back of the auditorium, I was sitting at the front so I could see all that was taking place. There were several soldiers at the back of the auditorium, and they clicked their heels together. And then each of them is holding a flag, and each of them begins to walk forward in this military orderly fashion. And they come around over this way, and then they started walking right up the front. I am sitting on the platform. I'm getting chills running all over me, watching these people come forward. They come forward, and they stop right at the front. They click their heels together, and everything is just memorized. I mean, every motion, every move is just like it's supposed to be. And two of them go this way, and two of them go that way, and exactly the same moment they stop. And exactly the same moment, they start coming up onto the platform. Then they walk onto the platform, and they come and they face each other, and they stop right in front of each other. They're presenting the colors. They're bearing these flags. They stop facing each other. The American flag is given the greatest prominence and the greatest priority, of course. And then they move to certain spots, and each of them at exactly the same moment drops their flag or puts their flag in its receptacle. And then the soldier that was bearing the American flag did some, I can't do what that soldier did. But that soldier then took the flag and did something like this. And then just very carefully made sure the flag was exactly like it was supposed to be. And every move is choreographed. Every move is coordinated. Every move is planned. And then steps back. And then the whole, this is taking 5 to 7 minutes at least. And everybody's just sitting there. And then the soldiers turn and they leave. And then at the close of the whole thing, they come back up and retire the colors. I was moved. I doubt I will ever forget what I saw that night. And it was like an emotional rallying point. The colors are here. We're Americans. We're not ashamed of it. I liked it. During the Civil War in 1862, Union supporter George Root wrote the song, "Rally Round the Flag, Boys," or "Shouting the Battle Cry of Freedom." Yes, we'll rally round the flag, boys, rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. We will rally from the hillside, we'll gather from the plains, shouting the battle cry of freedom. We will welcome to our numbers the loyal, true, and brave, shouting the battle cry of freedom. And although they may be poor, not a man shall be a slave. You realize how powerful that was? Shouting the battle cry of freedom. And the song itself was so moving, and it was used as a rallying song for the North and the Union and its supporters. But the tune was so good that the South could not neglect it, and they had to write their own songs, or their own words for it, for the Confederate troops to sing in the South. The flag that you fly says, "I'm glad to be connected with what this represents. I'm not ashamed of my connection with what this represents. I'm not ashamed of my connection with this flag. I'm not ashamed of my connection with this flag. I am glad for these flags to be representative of something in my life." I had only been in Lincoln a few months. Maybe just a few weeks. Brother Tony Skelnick was in our church at the time, dear brother in the Lord, still lives a few miles from here. And Brother Skelnick, for those of you who remember, know him. How many of you know Brother Skelnick? Let's see your hands. Brother Skelnick escaped from communist Poland in a fishing boat when he was a boy, and has a love for America that most of us don't appreciate unless you could have. I don't know. Is there anybody here tonight who actually lived behind the Iron Curtain under communism? We've got missionaries here who have seen the results of communism because they're in Romania. But anybody here actually lived? But Brother Skelnick actually lived behind the Iron Curtain and knew the repressiveness of communism and knew how to appreciate freedom. I'd only been here, I guess, a few weeks. And I forget what was going on. I was over at his house for something, and he had a flagpole in front of his house. And he said, "Brother Davis, I'm going to run up the flag. Would you like to join us as we run up the flag?" And so we went out in front of his house, 425 9th Street, and he ran the flag up, and I was standing there admiring it. What came next, I wasn't ready for. He immediately snapped to attention and said, "Now we're going to give the Pledge of Allegiance." And standing right there in the middle of the day in front of God, the world, and everybody, he starts giving the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I did too. I said, "Yeah, what else you going to do?" But it caught me. It grabbed me and said, "There's a man who appreciates that flag more than you do. There's a man who's not ashamed of that flag." Could I ask you a question? There is a flag for the Christian life. Are you ashamed of that flag? Do you gladly fly the flag of the Christian life, or are you ashamed of it? I don't know about you, but I get an emotional connection when I look at that flag, the Star-Spangled Banner. I think about my Grandpa Barry fighting in Germany in World War II or World War I. I think about my dad fighting on board the USS Wisconsin during World War II. I think about the times he told me, so many times he told me about the kamikaze pilots coming over and trying to sink the USS Wisconsin. And he told me about them, him helping to hand the shells to the gunners and the gunners shooting these guys out of the sky. And he told me about one day when one, it just looked like it was coming right for the ship itself. And it went just off the bow of the ship into the water. When I think of the flag, I think about my brother, Ronald, fighting in Vietnam during the late 1960s. When I think of the flag, I get an emotional connection. I think of the soldier in the Hanoi Hilton in Vietnam who took the scraps that he could gather and carefully sewed together a little American flag so that every morning he and the other prisoners, American captives there, could salute that flag and give the Pledge of Allegiance to it. I think about how his captors caught him with his flag, drug him out, destroyed his flag, beat him cruelly and mercilessly, till he was bloody and broken and bruised, and then threw him back in the cell. And shortly thereafter, one of his buddies said, "What you doing?" And he said, "I'm sewing another flag." I like that. Something about being an American, something about the freedom. I found this poem. There's so many flag poems. You wouldn't believe how many flag poems there are. H.C. Bunner wrote this, "The Old Flag." "Off with your hat as the flag goes by, and let the heart have its say. You're man enough for a tear in your eye that you will never wipe away. You're man enough for a thrill that goes to your very fingertips. Aye, the lump just then in your throat that rose spoke more than your parted lips. Lift up the boy on your shoulder high and show him the faded shred. Those stripes would be red as the sunset sky if death could have dyed them red. Off with your hat as the flag goes by. Uncover the youngster's head. Teach him to hold it holy and high for the sake of his sacred dead." A flag provides an emotional connection. I've heard stories about how our ancestors would come over on the boats from Europe or wherever it might be, and they would come into the harbor of New York, and they would see this, the Statue of Liberty and the American flag, and they would stand there and weep because they knew it represented liberty and freedom. Now let's pause here and ask a question. Why do many Christian Americans have more emotion about the American flag than the Christian flag? And the second question, is that wrong? If you're a true Christian, then your heritage as a Christian is the top priority of your life. It is more important to be a Christian than it is to be an American. In fact, Christians in most other countries don't even understand our love for the red, white, and blue. Many of them don't, they don't have a sense of patriotism for their flag or for their country. And by the way, if a country is not built on truth and justice and righteousness, then there is nothing to stir the heart toward patriotism like we get stirred. I repeat, it's more important to be a Christian than to be an American. Our first allegiance is to the Lord Jesus Christ, and that allegiance is greater than any allegiance to any president or governor. But most Christian Americans don't feel the emotional connection with the Christian flag that many feel for the American flag. And the reason, I believe, is simply this. The American flag for us is continually seen. We see it everywhere. and continually reminds us of the life and death of fighting men. It is continually an emotional reminder to us of the freedom that we have. Freedom to worship, freedom to speak, freedom to assemble. And though the Christian flag is a special flag, we don't have the continual connection with it that we have with this flag. You heard me tell about a church that got into a fight over which flag was going to be the highest on the platform. And I mean, it got into a bad fight over the American flag or the Christian flag. And the way they finally settled it was they took a sheet of paper and put it underneath the American flag so that those who were upset could say that it was higher than the... You know what? The fight was not needed. In fact, when you find out what the flag of the Christian life is, you'll find out how ridiculous that story is. Those are not meant to be competing kingdoms. They are separate kingdoms. Jesus said to Pilate in John 18:36, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews." But you don't see people, you hear of people who are persecuted for Christ, who are dying for Christ, that stirs your heart, but you don't see them moving out underneath this flag to do it, so you don't necessarily make the emotional connection, and I don't think it's really that big of a problem. I think the Lord understands it. Now, I'm going to tell you in a little while the identity of the flag of the Christian life, but I want to tell you right now that you should unashamedly be identified with that flag, and it should be an emotional rallying point for your life. I'm still talking about the importance of the flag for identification as an emotional rallying point. And thirdly, the flag is a symbol of victory. A symbol of victory. In Exodus chapter 17, Joshua and the children of Israel fought and defeated Amalek. Aaron and Hur held up Moses' hands on top of the mount so that the Israelites could win in the valley below. At the end of the victorious battle, Exodus 17:15 says this, listen to it, "And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi." It means the Lord our banner. That is the first occurrence that I can find in the whole Bible that refers to a banner or an ensign or a standard. Though there might be one other, the word translated ensign in one of the passages also shows up in Genesis chapter 1, referring to the signs of the sun and the moon in the heavens. And it's almost like God is saying, "I have put my flag in the sky where nobody can shoot it down. I have put the sun and the moon up there." But here is Moses building an altar and calling the name of the altar the Lord our banner. It was a symbol of victory. Isaiah chapter 11, verses 9 through 12 is a picture of future victory. "For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people," a flag of the people. "To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious." It is a picture of heaven. It's saying that we will seek to this flag, and God will give us a home in heaven. "And he shall set up an ensign," a flag for the nations, "and shall assemble the outcast of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." So the flag and victory again is tied together. It has been called the most reproduced photograph of all of history, and perhaps the most famous photograph of history. It is the picture of the raising of the flag on Mount Suribachi on the island of Iwo Jima, 750 miles from Tokyo. It was taken by Joe Rosenthal on February 23rd, 1945, and the picture you're looking at you might notice, is a little different than the picture you usually look at. And the reason that is so is because the ordinary picture that is seen is actually cropped closer. This picture was actually made from the original negative, and it was made in 1997 from the original negative. That is that split second shot that he took on top of Iwo Jima. An unknown writer wrote these words. The battle for Iwo Jima can be described in many ways. Most simply, 70,000 Marines routed 22,000 Japanese in a 36-day battle. It bore little resemblance to today's modern warfare. It was a fight of gladiators. Gladiators in the catacombs of the Colosseum fighting among trapdoors and hidden tunnels. Above ground gladiators using liquid gasoline to burn the underground gladiators out of their lethal hiding places. They were carrying flamethrowers that weighed over 70 pounds apiece. And they would take them and they would find these open caverns and they would shoot these flamethrowers in there. And they would either burn the Japanese to death or they would wipe out their oxygen supply and they would die of suffocation. Then they would head on. And they said the surprise thing was that 5 to 10 minutes later, Japanese would be coming out of those holes because the island was riddled with tunnels of all sorts and many had simply hidden further down in one of the tunnels. The Marines had overwhelming force and controlled the sea and the air. The Japanese had the most ingenious and deadly fortress in military history. The Marines had esprit de corps and felt they could not lose. The Japanese fought for their god emperor and felt that they had to die fighting. The geography, topography, and geology of the island guaranteed a deadly and bizarre battle. The large numbers of men and small size of the island ensured the fighting would be up close and vicious. The island was 2 miles wide and 4 miles long. Most of it was rather flat except for a 500 and something foot tall mount, Mount Suribachi, on one end of the island. 4 miles by 2 miles. If you're driving 60 miles an hour in your car, it takes you 4 minutes to drive 4 miles. Almost 100,000 men would fight on that little 8-square-mile island. It took the Marines 36 days to slog that 4 miles. Iwo Jima would be the most densely populated battlefield of the war, with 100,000 combatants embraced in a death dance over an area smaller than one-third the size of Manhattan Island. From the air, the island looked like a bald slice of black moonscape shaped like a pork chop. All its foliage had been blown off by bombs. The only life visible on the island were puffs of rotten egg stinking sulfur fumes coming from vents that seemed connected to hell. Correspondents in airplanes could see tens of thousands of Marines on one side of the island fighting against a completely barren side of stone. On foot, it was a morass of soft volcanic sand or a jumble of jagged rock. The Marines sought protection in shell holes blasted by the bombardment. Foxholes were impossible to dig. Either the sand collapsed in on you or your shovel failed to dent the hard obsidian floor. Bullets and mortars would come from nowhere to kill. The Marines would come across a cave or blockhouse and shoot and burn all its defenders to death. They would peer into the cavern and assure themselves no one was left there to hurt them. They'd move only to be shocked when that dead position came alive again behind them. The Marines thought they were fighting men in isolated caves and had no idea of the extensive tunnels below. A surgeon, listen to this, a surgeon would establish an operating theater in a safe place. With sandbags and tarp, he'd build a little hospital and treat his patients away from the battle. Then at night, when he lay down exhausted to sleep, he'd hear foreign voices speaking below him. Only when his frantic fingers clawed through the sand and hit the wooden roof of an underground cavern would he realize he'd been living on top of the enemy all along. The days were full of fear and nights full of terror. The Marines were sleeping on ground that the Japanese had practiced how to crawl over in the darkness. They knew every inch. Imagine sleeping in a haunted mansion where the owner is a serial murderer who knows the rooms and stairways and trapdoors by touch, and you're new. And then you can imagine the tortured sleep of those American Marines. Experienced naval doctors had never seen such carnage. Japanese tanks and high-caliber anti-aircraft guns hidden behind walls of rock and concrete ensured that the Marines would not just be cut down, but cut in half or blown to bits. A 75-year-old veteran of Iwo Jima would still reflexively open his bedroom window in 1999 after dreaming of the battle once again. 54 years after the battle, the stench of death still filled his nostrils from a dream, and he opens the window to get fresh air. The bodies lay everywhere. Young boys who had never been to a funeral became accustomed to rolling another dead buddy aside. Kids full of life worked on burial duty, unloading bodies from trucks stacked with death. Mothers back home would tear open the ominous telegrams with trembling fingers. The survivors would remember sailing away and seeing the rows and rows of white crosses and stars of David's. Almost 7,000 of the Americans died there. 20,000 casualties, 7,000 dead. Today, there are still over 6,000 Japanese dead, still entombed under the island, dead where they fell in their tunnels and caves. Military geniuses predicted a 3-day battle, an easy time. Some of the nicest boys America would ever produce slogged on for 36 days in what would be the worst battle in the history of the United States Marine Corps. Generals conferred over maps while tanks, airplanes, naval bombs, and artillery pounded the island. But it was the individual Marine on the ground with a gun that won the battle. Marines without gladiator's armor who would advance into withering fire. Marines who would not give up simply because they were Marines. A mint in Washington would cast more medals for these Iwo Jima heroes than for any group of fighters ever before or since in America's history. America would embrace those heroes, but they were enthralled by an image of heroism, a photo. Millions of words would be written in the United States about a split second that no one on Iwo Jima thought worthy of remark at the time. What was that split second? Somebody raised a flag. It was a symbol of victory. The importance of the flag for identification, for an emotional rallying point, as a symbol of victory. And then, what then is the identity of the Christian flag? Biblically, what is this flag that identifies us? What is this flag that is an emotional rallying point for us? What is this flag that is a symbol of victory for us? Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 4 says this. He brought me, and this is a picture of the church and Christ. There's much more there, but just suffice it quickly right now. This is a picture of the church describing Christ. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Song of Solomon, chapter 5, verse 10. My father-in-law preaching the other night at the banquet used this verse, and I called him last night and I said, have you ever seen this? You might want to make a note of this. Song of Solomon chapter 5 verse 10 says, my beloved, referring to our Lord, is white. It means pure and ruddy, and is referring to the blood that he shed. The chiefest among 10,000. Let me give you a little detail here that you could miss. The word chiefest there means he's the flag bearer. It is identically the same Hebrew word that is used to refer to the banner. And to the one who lifts the banner. He is the chiefest among 10,000. He is the one who lifts up the banner in front of all of us. His banner is love. Song of Solomon chapter 6 verse 10. Who is she that looketh forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, terrible as an army with banners. Years ago, we used to sing a little chorus here. And as I prepared this message, I thought how accurate that little chorus was. Love is the flag flown high from the castle of my heart. From the castle of my heart. From the castle of my heart. Love is the flag flown high from the castle of my heart. For the king is in residence there. So let it fly in the sky. Let the whole world know that the king is in residence there. His banner over me was love. John 13:34. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I've loved you, that you also love one another. He says, this is the banner you lift over your life as a Christian, that identifies you as a Christian, that is a symbol of victory for your life, that, is an emotional rallying point, and that is when you love. John 15:9, as the Father hath loved me, so have I loved you, continue ye in my love. 1 John 3:14, we know that we have passed from death unto life because we love the brethren. This is talking about, listen to me, it's not talking about some weak, flimsy, emotional kind of love. This is God's love. That's the love you want flying over your life. A love that lives for others instead of self. A love that will not, hear me, that will not give up hope. A love of commitment. A love of caring, a love of patience, a love of endurance, a love of truthfulness, a tough love, a love of self-sacrifice, a love that is gracious and kind and humble and forgiving. That flag is our identification, our rallying point. It is our symbol of victory. When the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord shall lift up a standard against him. When the enemy comes in like a flood with his hatred, with his anger, with his horror, with his terror, what is the rallying flag of the Christian life? It is to love like Jesus loved. Husband and wife, does the banner of love fly over your relationship? Always. Brother and sister, could I ask you, does the banner of love fly over your relationship? Brother and sister, does it identify to everyone that you're not like everybody else? You're not like the enemy because you've got a different banner to identify you. You have an emotional rallying point. You have a symbol of victory because brothers and sisters are supposed to love one another. Parents, does the banner of love fly over your relationship with your children? Not just emotional love, but the love that gives to the children what they need and that causes you to change where you need to change so that you can help them become what they ought to be. Children, does the banner of love fly over your life to your parents? Brothers and sisters in Christ, does the banner of love fly over our lives for each other? Every Tuesday night, the preacher whose 18-year-old daughter had sent word she would never come back. Every Tuesday night, the preacher's church had a prayer meeting. They don't preach, study the Bible, or sing. All they do is come together, go through prayer requests, and have prayer. 2,000 people come just to pray. It was a cold Tuesday night in February. Folks all over the auditorium knelt in their pews, and the preacher went to his seat, got on his knees, and began to pray. Just hours before that, he had been weeping, wrapped in a fetal position, crying out to God. 3 or 4 seconds into his prayer, one of the ushers tapped him on the shoulder and handed him a little note. He looked at the note and went to the pulpit with that note in his hand and said, "Folks, I know you're praying, but could I please have your attention?" It almost looked like a graveyard, they said, all over the auditorium. People's heads popped up behind the pews. He said, "Folks, Sister so-and-so is a godly lady and loves the Lord. And our dear sister tonight has written a note, and I'm almost ashamed to read it. There are many needs in our church. Everybody knows that my daughter is not living for God. But my wife and I have not tried to draw attention to ourselves. We've been more focused on your needs than our own needs. But This sister wrote a note and said, "Pastor, the Spirit of God has impressed upon my heart that we stop this prayer meeting and that the rest of the night we take one name to God. Preacher, could we pray the rest of this prayer meeting tonight that God would give our pastor's daughter back to him?" Big crocodile tears began to come down the preacher's cheeks, and he said, "Folks, I'm embarrassed to ask, but I wish you'd do it. My daughter doesn't know right from wrong anymore. She's so confused. Would you please pray that my daughter would get right with God?" As soon as he made that request, people flooded to the altar. Many were literally laying prostrate on the floor. People began to cry. There was travail and weeping. He said it was one of the most incredible prayer meetings he'd ever been in his life. When he got home that night, his wife had the children in bed and a coffee pot on. He sat down at the table and said, "Sweetheart, I've got some good news." And she said, "What is it?" He said, "Our little girl is going to get right." She said, "Who heard from her? What did she say? Where's she at?" He said, "Nobody's heard from her or seen her, but sweetheart, if you could have been at church tonight and heard what I heard and sensed what I sensed, God showed up tonight and he gave me hope that just any day now she's going to get right with God." Less than 36 hours later, about 7 o'clock on Thursday morning, the preacher was in his bathroom shaving. His wife burst through the door and said, "Come downstairs right now." He said, "Sweetheart, I'm shaving." She said, "It doesn't matter. Wipe the shaving cream off. Our daughter's here and calling for her daddy." He was literally scared to death. As he came down the steps, he could hear sobbing. He saw his beautiful daughter there kneeling on the floor with her shoulders heaving. When he called her name, she reached out and grabbed her daddy by the legs and just began to sob as she hugged her daddy's legs. He said, "Her picked her up off the floor, a frail young lady now. Sin had scarred her and taken so much away. And for the first time in years, he hugged his oldest daughter and he said, while we stood there and hugged each other, she looked at me and said, "Daddy, who was praying for me Tuesday night? Daddy, I needed to go to work Wednesday, so I went to bed early Tuesday night. But in the middle of the night, I had a nightmare. I saw hell and I was sliding into hell. And right before I fell over the edge, God reached out and grabbed me and saved me. And he said, 'Go home, get right. Your mom and daddy love you. It's not too late. Daddy, who was praying for me? Somebody was praying for me Tuesday night, weren't they?" September of that year, she went to Bible college, and today, the prodigal is a pastor's wife. You know why? It's just one of a thousand stories that could be told of when God's people fly the flag of love. It should be our identification in everything we do. It should be the rallying point for us. It will be. If we ever really have victory in any area of life, it'll be the symbol of victory, God's people's love for God and for one another that God gives to them. Would you bow with me, please? And with every head bowed and every eye closed, I ask you, is that kind of love flying over your home tonight? Is that flying over your life tonight? Does it identify you? When people see you, do they see that kind of love? Is that the victory in your life? A love that just won't let go of God for somebody else? A love that changes where you need to change because somebody else needs you to change? A love that moves you and stirs you and moves everybody else around you. What kind of love you got in your life tonight? Maybe there's somebody here tonight who's lost without Jesus. You didn't really understand much of what I said tonight, but understand this. Jesus' love is the ultimate love. He set the example by leaving heaven, coming to earth, and dying on the cross for us who were sinners, who are away from God, seeking our own way and our own will. And what love, what amazing love. And he loves you tonight and wants to save you if you're lost. Maybe there's somebody here tonight who's saved and needs to get baptized. You come. This is one of those messages, just almost all of us, if we're listening, God hit us somewhere tonight. Would you come? Father, bless the invitation now. In Jesus' name we pray. We're standing with heads bowed and eyes closed. God, speak to your heart. If God didn't speak to your heart, you ought to come. If God did speak to your heart, you